From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Joe Biden has been in office for 100 days, and in his speech to a joint session of Congress last night, he cataloged his achievements.
After 100 days of rescue and renewal, America is ready for a takeoff, in my view. We're working again, dreaming again, discovering again, and leading the world again.
He also outlined his American Families Plan, which includes free preschool, community college, subsidized childcare, and paid family leave. But Biden's progressive wish list could cost trillions, and Republican lawmakers oppose it. So let's spend some time now with NPR White House correspondent Ayesha Roscoe. Hi, Ayesha.
Hello.
And the speech last night came ahead of today's milestone, the 100th day in office. And he used the occasion to argue for things like universal pre-K and free two-year community college, as we said. Let's listen to a little of that.
Research shows when a young child goes to school, not daycare, they're far more likely to graduate from high school and go to college or something after high school. When you add 2 years of free community college on top of that, you begin to change the dynamic.
So we know this is just one part of the president's American Families Plan. Just first of all, tick off what else is in it.
There's direct aid for child care. The administration wants to make sure low and middle income families spend at most 7% of their income on child care. There's paid leave that would eventually lead to 12 weeks of paid leave to care for a new child or family member. And there are tax cuts for low and middle income families, lower health insurance costs, and a lot more. That's just some of the highlights.
Yeah. And this, of course, you know, you combine this with Biden's infrastructure bill. We're talking trillions here. Did he talk about or tell us more about what he said about paying for it?
He says he would pay for it by taxing the rich and corporations. The way the White House is pushing this is saying that this is really making the rich and corporations pay their fair share. The White House says these programs will be fully paid for over 15 years. The top tax bracket will go back to what it was before the Trump tax cuts. And millionaires would have to pay the same rate in taxes on their capital gains. So things like selling stocks, that would be taxed at the same rate as wages. And then they would also, the White House says that they believe by beefing up IRS enforcement, they can get about $700 billion in taxes from wealthy people who are evading paying those taxes.
Well, look, I mean, we're used to when the president of one party makes these traditional speeches, usually that party is jumping to its feet a lot and members of the other party are not. You know, last night we saw, you know, the Republican Senator Ted Cruz sleeping, it seemed, at one point. What did President Trump, President Trump didn't make any attempts to reach across the aisle. How would you characterize President Biden's message to Republicans?
Well, you know, his message was he seemed to go out of his way to not antagonize Republicans personally. Now, obviously, his proposals they didn't agree with, but he didn't try to necessarily go after them or insult them. He even complimented Mitch McConnell at one point, you know, for naming a bill after Biden's deceased son, Beau. And he even complimented Republicans for said he welcomed their proposal. Senate Republicans have a counter proposal to Biden's infrastructure plan that is $568 billion, much smaller and focused on traditional infrastructure, roads, bridges, broadband, things like that. He welcomed that. He said he's ready to talk. He wants to negotiate. Part of that is because not only does he need to reach out to Republicans, he needs to reach out to moderate Democrats because he needs to make sure that he's showing that he's trying to negotiate because as it stands, he's not going to have the votes for this just as it is.
Yeah. Well, we want to note the president also spoke about George Floyd and a conversation that he had with George Floyd's little daughter. Let's listen.
She looked at me, she said, "My daddy changed the world." Well, after the conviction of George Floyd's murderer, we can see how right she was, if if we have the courage to act as a Congress.
And he went on to urge Congress to pass a series of civil rights bills. Do they have a chance?
It's going to be difficult. He called for the passage of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which would ban chokeholds, altered so-called qualified immunity for law enforcement, and ban certain no-knock warrants. But this has a lot of pushback in Congress. Biden said he wanted it passed by the anniversary of when George Floyd died, which would be, I believe, around next month. But there are negotiations going on. This is going to be tough because there's a lot of pushback and questions about what you can really pass in Congress on these issues with broad support or with enough support to get it done. And there's a lot of other things on Congress's plate right now.
That's right. NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe, thank you.
Thank you.
In California, Governor Gavin Newsom is facing a recall election later this year, and there are already several Republicans lined up to replace him, including transgender activist and reality TV star Caitlyn Jenner. It's only the second time a recall of a California governor has been put on the ballot. Scott Schaefer of member station KQED reports on some hard lessons Democrats learned from the first one in 2003 when Governor Gray Davis was kicked out of office.
In July of 2003, California's top election official, Kevin Shelley, made a somber announcement.
As California's Secretary of State, it is my duty today to certify the first recall election of a governor in California history.
In California, there are two questions on a recall ballot. The first, should the governor be recalled, yes or no? And second, if the governor is recalled, who should the new governor be? Waiting in the wings that year, one candidate towered over the rest.
I'm going to run for governor of the state.
On The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, action movie star Arnold Schwarzenegger announced he was in. Republican operative Sean Walsh was there.
It was just a perfect Hollywood type of campaign event that happens once in a generation, and he was the right person at the right time to capitalize on it.
Then, like now, one question loomed large for Democrats who opposed the recall. Should a prominent Democrat get into the race as a backup? You know, in case Davis is recalled, just to make sure a Democrat wasn't replaced with a Republican. Cruz Bustamante was the Democratic lieutenant governor at the time. At first, Bustamante said he would not run in the recall. How sure was he?
Absolutely, absolutely, 100%.
But Bustamante soon changed his mind.
I'm here to tell everyone to vote no on the recall and yes on Bustamante.
Gary South was Gray Davis's campaign consultant.
And so to say no on recall, yes on Bustamante was oxymoronic to the average voter, and people didn't get what it meant.
But as Bustamante saw it, he was trying to be a kind of insurance policy for Democrats.
I decided to run in this race in order to protect the state against the kind of politics that I believed Arnold would bring to the state.
While some Democrats fumed when Bustamante got in, GOP consultant Sean Walsh says Team Schwarzenegger had a very different reaction.
High fives, low fives, toasts, tequila shots, rum raisin ice cream. It was a party all the way around if you were a Republican.
At the time, Gray Davis was enormously unpopular, with approval ratings in the 20s. So beating the recall was always going to be a tough climb. But Gary South says by jumping in, Bustamante caused even more problems for Davis. For one, it upended the message that the recall was a Republican plot. And some voters saw it as a way to replace the disliked Davis with the first Latino governor.
So Arnold was clearly our biggest problem, but Bustamante was a close second.
The lieutenant governor did get endorsements from some congressional Democrats and campaign cash from organized labor. But Bustamante, a Central Valley Democrat, had a hard time raising money and was no match for the star power of Schwarzenegger.
I knew what the consequences would be. If I lost, it may shorten my career. And I made the decision to run despite that.
Looking back, Bustamante says his decision to run was selfless.
I was taking one for the team.
But the team sure didn't appreciate it. Not only was Davis recalled, but Bustamante finished with 31% of the vote, far behind the winner.
Thank you very much to all the people of California for giving me the great trust.
3 years later, Bustamante, who was still lieutenant governor at the time, ran for state insurance commissioner, losing to a novice Republican, making him the last incumbent Democrat to lose a statewide election.
I have no regrets. So whatever came after that isn't good or bad, it just is. I'm very at peace with all of that.
With another recall heading for the ballot, Newsom's advisors are circling the wagons to make sure no other Democrat jumps in. But at least one is rumored to be thinking about it, former Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. For Here and Now, I'm Scott Schaefer.
Water managers in Nevada want Las Vegas to become the first major city in the country to ban grass that nobody really uses. It's called ornamental grass, and it's often planted at office parks or on medians. Digging it up could cut southern Nevada's water consumption by 10%, which is enough to supply 60,000 homes in Las Vegas for a year. Colby Pellegrino is with the Southern Nevada Water Authority. Colby, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
Ornamental grass, what is that exactly, and how much of it is there in Las Vegas?
So what we consider ornamental grass, the easiest way to think of it is if the only person walking on that grass is the person that's maintaining it, the landscaper mowing it. When we look across our community, we have about 12,000 acres of turf in the Las Vegas Valley, and we think about 5,000 acres meet that criteria where it's purely aesthetic. And of that, we think about 3,900 is outside of people's homes.
I see. And it looks nice, but it is also very thirsty. If you were to get rid of the grass that nobody walks on, how much do you expect to save? How much water?
So 1 square foot of grass uses about 73 gallons of water here locally. And xeriscape landscape, natural desert landscaping, uses about 19 gallons per square foot. If we get rid of that 3,900 acres, we estimate that we would save 9.5 billion gallons of water annually.
Hmm. So some years ago, developers in your area were banned from planting grass in people's front yards. And you've said this time, as you've been pitching this idea, that you're not coming after people's lawns in their backyards. But why not? Aren't there bigger targets here that could make a much bigger difference?
Well, again, as we look at all of that non-functional turf remaining, we do think there's probably 1,100 acres or so that are in people's residence. We acknowledge that there is a balancing act between having a good quality of life, having space for your children to play, an area for dogs, with the community's water needs. And we think this 3,900 is what makes the most sense for us to tackle first. We still do incentivize single-family residences to remove their turf, should they choose to do that. And we've been doing that for 20 years. We aren't ignoring single-family. We're just using other tools there.
The big picture here is that the West has been in a very, very, very serious drought. Last year, Las Vegas went 240 days without measurable rainfall. In some states along the Colorado River, the main source of water for the region, I mean, places like Las Vegas wouldn't exist if not for the Colorado River, they'll be facing cuts, including Nevada. How concerned are you about what is to come if this drought doesn't get any better?
That's a great question. So Southern Nevada is nearly fully reliant upon the Colorado River. We get 90% of our water from Lake Mead. As you discussed, we would not exist if it weren't for the Colorado River. But that said, we've been investing heavily to prepare for the eventuality of shortages. Between 2002 and today, our per capita water use has decreased by 47%. Our total consumption of water from the Colorado River has decreased by 23%. And during that same time, we've added 750,000 people to the Las Vegas Valley. So practically speaking, there's not a lot we need to do immediately because of that shortage, because we've been doing it for 20 years. The reality is things could get a lot worse on the Colorado River. So we need to be prepared to do more locally, but more broadly, the river community as a whole needs to be prepared and start thinking ahead about conserving water so that we're as efficient as we can be.
And is it fair to say that's what this ornamental grass ban is about? That even if your record has been pretty good, you still need to do more if you're going to get through this.
Exactly. This is the next step in what we've been doing for 20 years, which is getting more serious. Our community has really embraced the conservation ethic, every level, from homeowners to businesses to the resorts on the Strip. And we expect that to continue into the future. And I know this community can sort of rise to that occasion. What concerns me a little more is we have 1.8% of the allocated water on the Colorado River. We cannot change the Colorado River's destiny by ourselves. We need our other partners on the river to be just as responsible as we are with these resources.
Colby Pellegrino is Deputy General Manager of Water Resources for the Southern Nevada Water Authority. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
The drought here in the West is also making air pollution worse, so let's go now to Imperial County, California. It's a farming community near the Mexican border with a majority Latino population. A new report from the American Lung Association says that it has some of the worst air quality in the country. Luis Olmedo is executive director of Comité Cívico del Valle. It's an environmental justice group there. Luis, welcome. It's good to speak with you.
Yeah, hello, Peter. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, we're glad to have you. And it's probably no surprise to you that this report gave Imperial County really bad marks for air pollution. You live this every day.
Unfortunately, yes. I think a large part of the population sees it in their medical bills. We unfortunately live in an area that is surrounded by a mountain range. We share the air with three jurisdictions. On the north end, we have the South Coast Air Quality Management District, its own set of policies. On the south end, which is where we're at in Imperial, it's the Imperial County Air Pollution Control District. And even more concerning is that we are right at the border. So Mexicali, which is on the other side of the border, a metropolitan city, also has its own set of rules. I've heard they're pretty good rules, but not enforced as stringent as we wished they would be.
But the thing is, you're not Los Angeles. You're not San Francisco. What's going on? What's causing this?
We're a heavy industrial area. We not only, feed the nation, but I guess we help feed the world. And we're not talking about small farms. This is corporate America supplying the fast food, the restaurant, the markets. Yet we seem to not have policies that bring equity into the region as far as managing those air emissions coming from that. And look, we're next to the border, so we're no different than, ports of Long Beach or San Diego or Oakland. And we're part of corporate America.
One of the complicating factors here is the Salton Sea. And for those who don't know, it's the largest lake in California, kind of came about at almost an accident in history. Over the years, it's been shrinking, drying up. There's been agricultural waste and other pollution found there as the lake dries up. Toxic dust from the lake bed is blowing into your community. Tell us about that problem and the effect it has on people.
Well, this is a new source of pollution. And we're in a race. This ties back to climate. We've experiencing more persistent drought, and we're having to now displace the water that used to serve as a barrier between the toxic dust. And as we're displacing that water, sending it to larger metropolitan areas, who for whatever reason aren't putting a stop to their growth, their development, their demands. And now we're having to sort of be the sacrifice zone with all this toxic dust that's going to affect the entire region. And these toxic particles are going to continue to exacerbate asthma. We're among the highest per capita in terms of asthma among children. And depending on the toxicity, it could take one particle and end up resulting in, being a cause or root cause of a cancer. It is a climate catastrophe, but We are optimistic, though. I don't want to just paint a grim picture. We are very optimistic with this new administration that we can make progress.
It's hard not to be grim, though, at this time. I mean, the other health crisis that we're dealing with, that you're dealing with especially, is COVID-19. I remember speaking with a helicopter nurse last summer from Imperial County who was helping fly patients out of your region because the hospital there was at capacity. You know, we've seen research from schools like Harvard that show breathing polluted air can make COVID even worse and increase your chance of dying. So now you're dealing with that as well. I mean, is that something that you've noticed? Does it ring true to you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we're, again, you know, when you have a community that's underserved in terms of dealing with the health and the climate crisis, it's all here. This is the poster child of what climate crisis looks like. I mean, with COVID, our lungs were already compromised. Yeah, we're going to experience much, much more profound health impacts, including higher mortality rates per capita. You know, it's the action and the reaction thing.
You're even going as far as urging people to wear masks to protect themselves, not only from COVID, but from air pollution.
Well, I think that now that we've already, you know, gotten a little more comfortable wearing these masks, I'm thinking that we're probably going to try to advocate and have people wear them as a way to reduce their exposure to unhealthy air until we're able to control this. Yeah.
Luis Olmedo is executive director of Comité Cívico del Valle, an environmental justice group in Imperial County, California, talking to us about the air that he and other people there are breathing. Luis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
I'm Yoe Shaw.
I'm Kia Miakonatis.
We're the hosts of the NPR podcast, Invisibilia.
You can think of Invisibilia kind of like a sonic blacklight.
When you switch us on, you will hear surprising and intimate stories.
Stories that help you notice things in your world that maybe you didn't see before.
Listen to the Invisibilia podcast from NPR.
Russian dissident Alexei Navalny made his first court appearance since his hunger strike today, a strike he started because he said he wasn't getting the medical attention he needed for leg and back pain, as he serves a 2.5-year sentence for what supporters say are trumped-up parole violation charges. He also survived being poisoned last year, an act he blames on the Kremlin. Russian officials deny any involvement. The BBC's Steve Rosenberg joins us from Moscow, and you've seen the video from the jail where he's being held. How'd he look?
He looked gaunt, but that's not surprising when you consider that he was on hunger strike for more than 3 weeks. Now, that hunger strike is over, and he's gradually increasing his intake of food. But despite looking gaunt, he sounded a defiant note, and he used the opportunity, this appeal hearing, to take a swipe at President Putin. Referring to the Kremlin leader, he said, "The emperor has no clothes. His crown is falling down around his ears." He claimed that President Putin couldn't care less about Russia and was clinging on to power. He said that Russians are being turned into slaves. So despite everything, he was sounding defiant. But unsurprisingly, he lost this appeal, which was an appeal against recent conviction for slandering a World War II veteran. I mean, Mr. Navalny has lost every appeal he's been involved in recent weeks and months. So I think his team weren't expecting this one to work out for him today.
Well, his supporters feel the fix is in. And Steve, I just want to ask you briefly, he survives a poisoning, most feel, by the Kremlin. He comes back. When he lands, he's detained, arrested. He's not getting the medical treatment he needed. He goes on this hunger strike, which he gradually ends to get the medical care he needs. But he survives that as well. Is this just building this, maybe even a myth around him, that he's unbeatable, even though he's in jail?
Well, to a certain extent, that is the kind of myth that is being created, absolutely. You have to ask, I mean, is this the act of a very courageous, a brave man, a reckless man? I mean, you know, coming back to Russia, he would have known that he would have been arrested. And that's exactly what happened. But Mr. Navalny, is a political creature. And he knew that if he remained outside of the country, then that would be the end of his political career. He felt that he had to come back to Russia to continue his political battle with President Putin. And I think the Kremlin hadn't been expecting him to return. They were shocked that he decided to return. But this is definitely a thorn now in the side of President Putin, because every time President Putin will meet foreign or Western leaders, the name Navalny will be mentioned. It's a name that even President Putin himself can't bring himself to actually pronounce.
Well, the Kremlin is now targeting Navalny's organization, calling them extremist. What is endgame here?
Yeah, I mean, the pressure really is mounting now. And his allies today announced they were disbanding Mr. Navalny's network of regional offices across Russia, basically in an attempt to protect people who work for his organizations or are some way linked to it. But if this goes ahead, if his movement is labeled extremist, then that has far-ranging consequences. It means that anyone linked to Mr. Navalny's regional offices or foundations could face criminal punishment.
The BBC's Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. We will continue to follow this with you. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
For signs of spring, look no further than Holland, Michigan. The city's annual Tulip Time Festival is back. It was canceled last year for the first time ever because of the pandemic. And even though this weekend's celebrations won't feature the usual parades and performances, miles and miles of colorful tulips will still be on display. Thanks to people like Steve Zweep. He is the former parks supervisor for the city of Holland. He just recently retired, and he joins us now. Steve, congratulations on that retirement.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be with you.
Oh, everyone calls you the tulip guy because you've been in charge of all the bulb planting for the past 15 years. And this year, I understand about 500,000 tulips were put in the ground. How do you do that?
Well, it's a lot of time and effort. It's mostly all done by hand. We have a staff of about 10 people that help get this in. We also have volunteers from the community to come in and plant one of our parks, which is a great help to the park department.
Well, I bet. So for people who have never been to this festival, maybe have never heard of Holland before, paint a picture for us. What does it look like? I'm sure it's gorgeous and colorful.
Yeah, it is beautiful. Right now we are at peak color. This weekend is going to be at peak color. Next weekend there's still going to be a lot of color because it's cool this weekend, and so that's going to hold the color. But we've got all shades of lavenders, purples, pastels, reds, yellows, oranges. We blend them all together to create a palette of color that delights a lot of people.
Well, the festival was canceled for the first time last year because of the virus. That had to be disappointing for folks. Did it hurt?
It did hurt. It was disappointing. But the tulips still came up, and we still had a bunch of visitors that came in. They came in as far as New York. So we probably had about 40,000, 50,000 visitors throughout a two-week period last year.
Tell me about the Dutch connection there in town with all those tulips and with a name like Holland. I have a feeling you've got some ties there.
Yes, we do. Back in 1847, Dr. Albertus van Ralty came from the Netherlands to get a fresh start to set up his church the way that he thought it would be. So he came to Holland and built a community here, and that's how we got our roots. And over the years, people from the Netherlands kept immigrating to Holland, and they brought their culture with them. And part of that culture was the Dutch bulbs.
Wow. So you're retired, as we said, from the Parks Department now. Is this a situation where you're like, no more flowers for me ever again? Or are you like, okay, I can focus on putting the tulips in my own garden now?
It's not that at all. We plant behind the tulips summer annuals, and those summer annuals are just as spectacular as the tulips are. I really like those better than the tulips. I shouldn't say that, but it's true. But I probably will be volunteering to help plant some of those because our park department needs a little bit of help with that, because that's a big undertaking. We plant about close to 100,000 annuals every year in the city of Holland.
Wow. Well, I'm going to have to take a trip out to Holland, Michigan, to see all these flowers and all the color. I think we could use some of that in our lives right now. Steve Zweep, former park supervisor for Holland, Michigan, the annual Tulip Time Festival gets started this Saturday. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure being on your show.
And if we haven't painted enough of a picture for you, we've got pictures at hereandnow.org.
It's spring. A chorus, a cacophony is greeting us, including the, whatchamacallit, that thing there. We thought it would be a great idea to get a primer on bird calls from across the country, and that's why we've brought in Jesse Barry, a program manager at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Jesse, how many bird sounds do you think you've got gathered there?
Oh, we are right on the cusp of 1 million bird sound recordings, actually hitting that number just this week. So, yeah.
Well, congratulations. We'll play all of them. No, a few. But remind us, why so many in the spring?
Yeah, you know, spring is an amazing time to listen for bird sounds because song is the primary way that birds attract their mates. So they're showing, you know, the females in the community that this is the spot to be, and they're getting ready for the breeding season.
There we go. Well, let's go out west. Here's a bird that's heard across the west. Ooh.
Yeah. Canyon Wren is one of my all-time favorite bird songs because it's just this beautiful set of whistles that are cascading. You can hear their song echoing off of canyon walls and large rock structures, creeping along those rocks and picking off insects along the way.
Is that them too, that little beep beep at the end?
Yeah, the beautiful whistle and then just give that little raspy note at the end.
Okay, now we want to hear an owl, a barred owl.
Barred owls are living in forests across the east, and they've recently expanded their range to the northwest.
That's not a hoo. This is a like a trumpet.
Yeah, so the greenhorned owl does that classic hoo hoo hoo. And barred owl does this, you know, series of notes that might sound like who cooks for you, who cooks for you all.
Let's listen. Who cooks for you, who cooks for you all?
Yeah, and, you know, when you're learning bird sounds, it can be helpful to put words to what you're hearing. You can practice your barred owl. If you do get it, they will come in and check you out.
I want to ask you that. I love bird calls, and I feel like I can call my cardinal. Can you?
Yeah, it's not something that you want to do too often, but just a little bit of song can be a wonderful tool to see birds, but we wouldn't want to tax any individual by playing that recording for too long.
Okay, duly noted. I think my cardinal just knows, mm-hmm. Oh, we're feeding, and it's a robin outdoing it. Well, let's listen to the cardinal. I just love their call. What else should we be listening for here on the East Coast?
On the East Coast, the brown thrashers are around in kind of scrubby field types of areas. And thrashers are mimics, like mockingbirds. They learn their vocalizations from other species of birds nearby.
You also have the wood thrush from the east. Let's listen.
It's one of the most iconic bird songs, this classic flute-like song, and it resonates through the forest and is just absolutely phenomenal to listen to.
How about we go to the Gulf Coast or the southern U.S.? What would you want us to listen for?
The laughing gulls are always present on the beach where you hear them calling to each other. And they indeed sound like they're laughing.
Is there a bird you want to point out that covers the country?
Yeah, the American robin is found across the continent, and listening to the robins in the morning can be, you know, an absolutely wonderful way to welcome in the spring.
We hope people are listening to Robbins. But you also mentioned the common nighthawk. See, that sounds like a peeper.
Right. Yes, it does sound like a spring peeper. And, you know, we often think of bird vocalizations as these beautiful whistles that we've just heard. And this one is rather harsh, but it's also distinctive. So the short note is loud and it can help you find nighthawks.
Terrific. Jesse Barry, again from Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Is there one that you've perfected that you're kind of proud of?
I have worked on my bard owl over the years. I can give you a hoot if you'd like.
Please.
All right. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Okay, let's have my cardinal meet your bard owl.
Oh, that's excellent.
Jesse, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
We'll have sounds at hearnow.org.
Earlier this month, René Campayon went out for a hike in California's Angeles National Forest for what he thought would be a two-hour walk in the woods. Well, he got lost, spent the night in the wilderness completely unprepared. The next morning, with his cell phone battery nearly drained, Campayon climbed a mountain where he could get a faint cell signal, snapped a couple photos, and sent them to a friend, pleading for help. Only one of those pictures made it through. It showed the lost hiker's legs blackened with soot, a rocky canyon landscape in the distance. His friend brought it to the police for help, and the LA County Sheriff's Department shared the image on social media. That's where Ben Kuo comes in. He saw the picture on Twitter and got to work using satellite images. He was able to pinpoint the location so rescuers could find Campayon. And they did. Ben Kuo joins us now. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show.
And, you know, my goodness, when I first saw this story in the Washington Post, I thought to myself, thank God for people like this guy, Ben Kuo. You really could have saved Renee's life. How are you feeling about all this?
I am always just relieved to hear that he was found and safe. It was really amazing to me that they took my advice and went to the place I said I thought he was, and they actually found him there.
Okay, well, let's try to figure out how you did this. You work in tech, and you have some techie hobbies. One of them is using satellite images to find out where photos or films were taken, and that's how you did it. What clues did you start with?
What I did is I looked at the satellite images that are taken almost every day over the Earth. There's actually open source satellites where you and me can go out to the internet and see what things on Earth look like. And one of those had captured an image of the Angeles National Forest where Renee had been lost. And I looked at those photos and did a little bit of sleuthing around, trying to figure out where he might be based on what the photos look like. And then I used Google Earth and some other tools to look at that in 3D. And found an area that looked exactly like what was below his feet.
Okay, well, that's where I want to stop you, because when I see the photo that you were looking at, it's the picture of Renee's, you know, dirty legs with some stuff in the background, but not very much. I mean, I think an untrained eye wouldn't actually see very much. What did you see?
Yeah, well, one of the things in the photo was the bottom of the canyon that his feet was below his feet had a lot of green in it. And if Los Angeles, there's a bobcat fire that was a big wildfire last year. And so the hillsides were pretty burnt. But in the photo, it was green. And there's only a certain area in the satellite photo where it was also green in the bottom of the valley.
Hmm. So then you were able to narrow it down to this one area?
Yeah, I was able to narrow it down to one part of the satellite photo. And using those tools to look at the scene in 3D, it was almost like a jigsaw puzzle, figuring out what part of those hills matched up. One hill may look like another, but if you rotate it around and look at it, you can actually find a match.
Wow. What did the sheriff's department say when you went to them and said, hey, I think I figured this out?
Well, actually, I was afraid that they wouldn't actually take my suggestion and look at it. But I guess I do have people who follow me on Twitter for fire season, because I often tweet about what's going on with the fires. And somebody there who knew I actually had an idea of what I was doing had them look at it. You know, I was afraid that they think I'm just another armchair detective with a wild goose chase. And fortunately, it was not.
Well, you were right. I mean, the sheriff's department took your advice. They checked this area out. They found him, which is just amazing. What other mysteries have you solved?
You know what? I don't know if I've solved any other mysteries. This is the first time I think I've seen such an immediate payback on stuff I looked for. I do love looking at the satellite maps and looking at what's going on out there. And there's a lot you can do with the resources out there.
By the way, when you spoke with Renee after he was rescued, how did that conversation go? What was that like?
It was amazing. Seeing Renee back with his family, it just actually gives me a really good feeling that something that I did had such a positive impact. I was worried that they might find a body instead of a person. You know, too often, if you look at search and rescue, especially it was going to be really cold that night. I think it was supposed to be 32 degrees Fahrenheit and 30-mile-per-hour winds. And considering he wasn't wearing much more than a T-shirt and shorts, I don't know how that would have turned out.
Well, I'll say it again. Thank goodness for people like Ben Kuo. You used satellite information to find a lost hiker in California. Ben, thanks for telling us about it.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
And we wanted to talk to Rene Campillon too, but when we got a hold of him, he said he couldn't do an interview because he's now under investigation by the U.S. Forest Service. He was found in a restricted burn area. You're not allowed to go on that land. He faces a misdemeanor charge, but he did tell a local CBS affiliate that he's grateful to the search and rescue team and that his message on the mountain got out. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.